Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing Podcast.
I want to get a description of everything that you saw out there, and then I want you to come down and identify the body as the body that you hooked. I said, let me tell you something, pal. If you go down there and you look at the right hand and the ring finger of the right hand, you're going to see a little small orangish fly. And that should be identification enough. Or if there's too many more bodies out there with little orange flies in it, I'm not fishing here anymore.
That was Hal Jansen describing one of his craziest catches on the fly. Stillwater Secrets, PG&E, and Classic Cars today on Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the show. If you've been listening to this podcast, have been enjoying the content, and want to support us and everything we have going here at The Swing, you can click over and support one of our sponsors. That would be amazing. In the show notes, there's usually a link there. You can check in with them, say hi, let them know you found and heard about them through this podcast. And one of those great sponsors today is Angler's Coffee, roasting a full range of coffee with that one goal, delivering excellent coffee to every single angler. With a blend for every taste, a dry dropper on the go, tea bag option, and a roast sampler, you know Joe at Angler's has you covered. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/anglers right now to support Anglers and this podcast, a sustainable company with unsurpassed taste. We're also sponsored today by Lake Lady Rods, building distinctive custom rods, each created one at a time to the exact specifications for each angler. You can go to wetflyswing.com/lakelady right now. That's LAKELADY to support this podcast and Chris and Lake Lady. Hal Jansen, one of the big-time Stillwater gurus, shares his story of fishing and his life around fly fishing and everything he's had over the years. We find out why he uses a super ultra-light outfit for trout in Stillwater and for steelhead and salmon. We're talking light gear. We also find out how he landed a sturgeon on some of this light gear and a bunch of other stories of fishing with some of the biggest names that, you know, we've talked about, some of them that aren't with us anymore. But Hal's been around. He knows pretty much everybody. This is a really great episode. I think you're going to love this one. So without further ado, here he is, Hal Jansen. How's it going, Hal?
Oh, man, it's going great. I'm sitting here looking out the window and looking at the big Chico Creek out there. And, you know, it's just beautiful. I mean, one of those days where it's clear, you know. There's been so many fires in the area lately. It's been kind of nice to be able to look out there and see everything the way it's supposed to be.
Right. Yeah, you guys have been getting some smoke up there this year already?
Yeah, everybody's burning, you know. It seems like, you know, there's one over in Yosemite that's going pretty good, I guess. And we haven't had anything around here. We had the big one a couple of years ago, and it kind of nailed Almanor and all that area. But it's looking pretty good now.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. Well, I think today what I want to dig in, you have a book on Stillwater, and you're a pretty one of the bigger names in Stillwater. You know, you've been out there a while, so I want to dig into a little bit of that, and maybe we'll touch on some steelhead and salmon. But before we jump into some topics, maybe some tips and things like that, let's hear about how you first got into fly fishing.
Well, I'm, you know, almost 80, and I've been fly fishing, you know, since I was, like about 5 years old. My dad had an old bamboo fly rod. It was, in the garage collecting dust, and I dug it out, and I said, what the heck is this, you know? And my dad said, oh, that's a fly rod, you know? I said, what do you do with it? And it had a little Yuko reel on it, you know? And he says, well, strips the line out, and I'll show you what it's all about. And that was it. Well, I mean, I was stuck. And from then on, every spare moment for the next 30 years, I was fly fishing. You know, I went to school at San Jose State, and in between classes, I'd run over to the San Lorenzo River, fish for salmon and steelhead. And when I wasn't doing that, I was in the parks, you know, fishing some of the little parks they had in the area. And, you know, I just had a love for it, you know, and a burning desire to just go out there and be fishing every single day that I could. And so, you know, most of my, actually, I'm probably better known as a pinstriper because I do pinstripe cars and boats and stuff like that for years at car shows all over the United States. So I traveled around, and that gave me the opportunity to fish in some of the areas that I would normally not be able to fish. And, you know, through Montana and all that area when I was traveling. And so, you know, fishing is just my life. It's part of my life, and that's what I do.
You've been doing it. So at what point, what was your first like dollar made in fishing?
Well, I tied flies when I was like 6 years old. I tied flies for Copeland Feeders in San Jose. And then I started tying flies for everybody. There was a guy by the name of Golden. He had a place called Golden's Fly Shop, Tackle Shop. And so I tied flies for him. And, you know, if I wasn't doing homework, I was doing that. But I rode a bus. Actually, I rode a bus every morning, a Peerless bus, from Fremont to San Jose, which was about a 45-minute trip. Okay, and then I'd get off the bus in San Jose. You know, I mean, I was in the third grade when I started going there. And then my brother was in the first grade. So I would take my brother and I, and we'd walk all the way to the school, which was probably about 10 blocks. And so I was in really, really good shape. And after school, you know, you had bus schedules. And so sometimes the bus schedules were right on. And I got there right on. And we were able to take off. But sometimes they weren't. And I went over to Copeland Feeders and, you know, look at all their flies. And eventually start tying flies for them. I tied flies for everybody. I mean, you know. And then I was a pretty good student. So, you know. And I was going to the San Lorenzo, fishing Alameda Creek in Fremont, you know, fishing all the quarries, everywhere. I mean, everywhere where there was water, I fished. My dad and mom had a piece of property in Milpitas, California, and they sold it. That's where the Ford plant went in over there. And some guy came in one night with a suit on, you know, and a tie, and he said, I want to buy your piece of property in Milpitas. And my dad started laughing, you know, because it was always a joke. If you wanted to give somebody an intimate, you stuck it in Milpitas. And my dad humored the guy, and he says, well, what will you give me for the property? And my dad's, he said, oh, I'll give you $50,000 for it, you know. And my dad started laughing. He says, have you been drinking? I said, no, I haven't. And he says, well, I'll tell you, anytime you want to pay me $50,000 for my property in Milpitas, I'll take it. And so with that, we went down and we bought a brand new Cadillac and a little travel trailer. And my mom and dad and my brother and I, we took off and we went around the United States.
Wow.
We went up to Oregon, Washington, all the way across the top, all the way to New York. And we had some relatives in New York. We stayed with them for a couple of days. And went fished all the lakes in Minnesota and all through there. I mean, I was a pest. We couldn't stop and have lunch unless there was water, you know. And my dad said, well, let's pull over here, you know. And I look at it and I said, that doesn't look like a very good place to fish that. Can we keep going? Yeah, sure. You know, sometimes we start to have lunch about 1 o'clock. We were going to have lunch at 1. It'd be 2 o'clock before I found it a place that was satisfactory for me to fish, you know, and for them to have lunch.
Right.
So anyway, that's kind of where it started. And
how old were you when you traveled around the country with your family?
About six, seven.
Wow.
Yeah, I was nuts. I mean, Nobody, I don't think anybody had such a desire to fish like I did. And it's still that way. I mean, I still, you know, I'm out all the time.
Huh. Are you, and back when you were seven, were you fly fishing?
Yeah. I started with a fly rod because I didn't know anything else. And that's what my dad had. He had that bamboo rod. And that was it. So, I mean, I was fly fishing for bluegill, bass, anything. If there was water, it had fish in it, and I was out. You know, I was in there popping bugs, streamers, you know. And then I got a fly tying kit for Christmas that same year that we sold the property. And, you know, after that, it was like, you know, we were pheasant and duck hunting. All the feathers, I had boxes and boxes of feathers still from way back then. You know, sprig and mallards and what have you.
All right. So,
you know, my whole life has been around fishing. And we're very fortunate that we have a nice home above Chico, 12 to 15 minutes above Chico, depending on how you're driving. And, you know, I can look out and see just unlimited mountains. I can see Mount Lassen out of one window here, and I can see downtown Chico from out the other window.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Yeah. You're in a cool spot. So that's really cool. So basically, the fly tying was going. I mean, who were back then, who were you learning to tie flies from? Did you just grab a book, and how'd all that look?
Well, I got a fly tying kit, you know, and that book had a little soft cover deal in it. I still have that. I'm sitting in my office here with all my books that I've got and all the decoys and stuff, fish. And I've got all the stuff that I've collected down through the years, you know. And I mean, that's, you know, almost 70 years of collecting. And I've got books on everything here. People have written books and sent me copies of it and copies of my books and drafts of my books and everything, you know. So, you know, it's my whole life is in this room, you know, and I'm looking up at a yellowtail that I caught that was a world record out of fly rod.
Oh, wow. Describe that room for, we can't see it because we're on audio, but describe it a little. What's it look like as you look around?
You know, on my right side here, I'm sitting in my fly tying desk right now and my carving desk because I do a lot of fish carving. And to the right outside, right out the window, I'm looking at the canyon across the way there, and Big Chico Creek is running down at the bottom of the canyon there. I mean, it's probably about 3 miles down to the bottom of that canyon.
Oh, wow.
And so I look to the right, and I can see Mount Lassen up that canyon. And as far as I can see to the left, because it winds around, like, I can see parts of Chico. You know, and up here, you know, there's ponds everywhere. You know, water company, PG&E and water company, you know, have been putting ponds everywhere. And for years, I just specialized in little ponds and little areas that were, you know, available to me, you know. And I just love this still water fly fishing. And so, you know, somebody said, why don't you write a book? And laughed. Yeah, right. I'll write a book. And, you know, it got to the point where everybody, I go to these fly fishing clubs and I talk about still water. And somebody said, man, you want to do a book on fly fishing on still water.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, so here about 10 years ago, I started collecting all my notes together and I started writing this book. And I illustrated the whole thing because eventually I initially was when I went to college, I was going to college as a, you know, commercial artist. And I learned watercolor, how to paint watercolors and for my pinstriping work. And so everything is in this book. Every step of the way is in this book and everything is done here, right at this desk, which I'm talking at from right now.
Remind us the name of the book.
It's called Stillwater Fly Fishing Secrets.
Nice.
And there's a picture of me on the back cover with a 20-pound rainbow trout that I caught up at Lake Almanor, which is above us here. I got a house up there, and my son is living in it right now. And during the summer months, that's where I spend a lot of my time. But there's just water everywhere. I mean, everywhere you look. I mean, you drive down the freeway, for Christ's sakes, and there's ditches running across, you know, running to the Sacramento River, running to, you know, Chico Creek, wherever it may be. And all of it's got salmon and steelhead in it. And when I was living, initially I lived in Santa Rosa. And that was before I did the book. And I was going up the coast all the time, You know, I fished with Bill Shad. I fished with Ted Linder. I fished with all the famous fly fishermen, Jim Adams, Ed Rice, who had this fishing tackle shows.
Yep.
That I traveled around the country with him, and I was doing programs for him. And I just got involved in it all. And it's been my life. So, you know, why not? If you can make a buck out of it and you can keep alive, I'm not eating steak sandwiches. I'm eating more peanut butter and jelly.
Right. Yeah. So basically, you've been doing this your whole life. I mean, you've been fishing. And but the book came in 2012. So before that, was that your first book you wrote?
That's my first book that I wrote. I was doing lots of fly fishing articles for Field & Stream, Outdoor Life. You know, Fly Fisherman magazine when it was going good. And so, I mean, you know, I look up here, you know, in front of me, and I see all these books and magazines and everything. But this is my life.
Yeah.
I mean, if anything happened to this room right here, I'd be just devastated. But, you know, from that, I started doing watercolor of fish. And, you know, it just snowballed. And it's a great life. I mean, I couldn't have planned it any better. And got so many good friends all over the country. Dave Whitlock in Kansas and Paulie Rossborough was a good friend of mine. And, you know, it just goes on and on and on.
I was going to ask you about, I think if we have time, we'll probably dig in a little bit, talk about that, some of the people that influenced you along the way, or maybe that you influenced as well. But I'm interested. I want to talk a little about start with the Stillwater, because you've got this book and I don't have it in front of me, but I'd like to dig into the book a little bit, because we've actually done, I love Stillwater fishing. We've had a number of people on the podcast, some folks up in Canada and probably some people, you probably know them, right? Some of the same guys, Denny Rickers and Brian Chan, right? The group out there. But I'm curious on your book. So talk about, because we've had some other like Team USA people that are doing like Euro style, right? Using a different style. And I've heard things like, you know, you got the Chronomid stuff, you got the like, you know, using a thing on your boat to slow it down. Like, what is your book? What's your technique? Do you cover everything in this book, or is it specific to a certain type?
Everything. How to fish out of a boat, how to fish out of a float tube, who started the float tubes, why they're so effective, because they're quiet, you know, and the boats mostly are small prams, 8 foot, and they're made out of fiberglass. And we fish salmon and steel out of those heads out of those boats during the winter months. And then during the summer months, I've got them spot with I got a little trailer now, and the boat's flamed, and, you know, with flames. I did pinstriping, so, you know, when the boat got a little shabby looking, I just got a deal of paint, and I start painting the boat, and I flamed it up.
Nice. So you got your boat all blinged out. Your boat looks nice.
Yeah. Yeah, so we had a lot of fun. I've had a lot of fun doing everything with this. And, you know, what else can I say? It's been my life.
Well, on the float tubes, you mentioned the float tubes. So do you know the history there? Because I don't remember, I just remember float tubes always being there. Do you remember when there weren't float tubes?
Well, yeah. I was about 15 years old when I saw the first float tube. And that was in Idaho. And it wasn't manufactured by a major company. You know, Mike Wolverton and all the guys up in Idaho fished Henry's Lake every year. And Gary Howells, who was probably one of the best bamboo rod builders in the world, he died a number of years ago. But all these people, we always used to meet up at Henry's Lake during the summer months, and we used to fish up there. Joe Brooks, we used to fish up there for, you know, several months, and then we'd all split up when the weather got bad, and everybody would go their way, you know. Joe and Mary used to camp right alongside of me, and I just had my little Ford van with a little bed in the back of it and a little stove, gas stove inside.
Nice.
And I cooked there, you know, and then sometimes we'd go to dinner up there, and, you know, we'd all get together. And Jim Adams was very, very influential. He's from Berkeley and a tackle collector, antique tackle collector.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's got rods and reels and stuff that, you know, most people wouldn't even believe. And I've got a picture of him sitting right in front of me. I saw his picture a while ago, and I should have brought his name up sooner.
Yeah.
But Jim has been a good long friend of mine. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, everything is in this book. You know, it's like with my pinstriping background and my watercolor background was from the pinstriping. Hell, I can illustrate anything. So why not do a book?
In your book, did you do the illustrations in the book?
Everything. Everything in the book. There's anything here that I didn't do. Everything is here. All the logo, my dragonfly logo, hex flies. Everything is done in watercolors, and it's in the book.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, Jane and I edited the book ourselves here. And, you know, you can't put it down. I've had people tell me. I started reading the book, you know, at the front of it. And, you know, I was just going to read a couple of pages. Next thing I know, I'm laying in my bed, falling asleep almost, and I'm halfway through the damn book.
Yeah.
You know?
Walk us through that book a little. Let's open that thing up and just talk. Like, what do you, like, chapters-wise, what can we expect to find there?
Well, it's chapters. Well, I'll go to the glossary here. And, you know, I acknowledge people here. Art Agnew, who had Sunset Line Company, and Bill Archuleta, who is still building reels. Johnny Barris, Lynn Bearden, who had the Mill Pond. Walt Bennett. I mean, just all these people were in here. Most of them are gone now. But Russell Chatham did an introduction for me in the front. And John Spencer, who was probably one of my best friends, and he's living over in Eureka somewhere now. And it's still a contour of the lake, you know. I mean, hell, I'm only at page 5, and all these things are already been covered. Ecosystems and weathered vegetation, all the insects, vegetation, are all illustrated in here. You know, the adults and the nymph and all the vegetation that you find in these ponds from British Columbia, like Dragon Lake in British Columbia, there's a picture here with vegetation and it just goes on and on. I mean, it starts there, and then trout senses and behavior, why a fish does certain things. And when you read this book, you won't believe it. You won't believe it. You know, then we get into fly tying and hooks, uh-huh. And I talk about hooks and how they're made. And hell, we're on page 44 now. Here's a book that's 270, almost 300 pages. And that's just touching the scratching the surface.
Right.
Of what we do.
That's it.
And everything, all my notes that I've collected after every fishing trip, I sit down and I made a note in a log of everything that I did that day and why. And you know, people talk to me about, oh, wow, you use a long leader and you use a 2-weight fly rod and you do that. Well, you're kind of crazy. No, it's important if you're fishing still water to use the lightest outfit possible because you're fishing with leaders that are 6X and 7X, pound 1 pound, 2 pound, and you're fishing, I'm catching fish 10, 8, 9, 10 pound fish on 6X leaders.
Wow.
Why am I able to do that? It's because my little reels are counterbalanced, so they give up line without any problem. The backing is not 20 pound or 50 pound. It's 6 pound and 8 pound braided, you know, line, nylon. And why do I use nylon and not use Dacron? It's because nylon stretches. Well, doesn't the stretch cause your reel, you know, to pop? Yes, it would if it was being stretched with heavy, heavy line. But no, it doesn't. So when all these things, what kind of fly lines? I use a black fly line. Where do you get a black fly line? Well, you get it out of a box of red dye. You get it at the grocery store. And you put a little bit of red dye in some boiling water, and you drop the fly line. It doesn't hurt the fly line. The PVC takes it like a duck takes the water. And I make my fly line black. Why that black? It's because when you're casting over fish that are a couple inches under the surface or even a foot under the surface, the black fly line makes no flashes. Why do you see it? And it may be seen, but not by the fish. But more people are scaring fish with light-colored lines and orange lines and pink lines and what have you. Mm-hmm. And that's in the book. That's the reason I do it. Why do I do it? How do I do it? It's in the book.
Yeah. So black fly lines. And is there not, can you not buy a black fly line out of the, like from a, on, at a fly shop?
No, you can't. Not unless it's been dotted. Somebody has to buy it.
That's right. So they're all colored. So that's interesting. So there's no black lines.
Yeah, there's no black lines. So you have to do it yourself. And with the backing, heck, when you're fishing 6X tippet, Why would you have 25 or 30 pound test backing? The fish is never going to see that backing, you know? So when it gets to, when it gets into the backing, you let them go. And the reels are all counterbalanced. So they're smooth running little teeny reels that are, you know, 3 inches in diameter, the smallest of the Hardies, you know, because they're some of the best reels that ever made. Everything I do is completely different from what people talk about in Stillwater. Like Denny, he shows a lot of pictures in his books, and he's a great guy. Denny's one of my favorite guys.
Yep.
All these pictures are in his book. And he fishes a heavy graphite rod, and there's where you break off lines more than anything else. You know, you break off leaders because the rods will not absorb the shock. If the fish pulls down on it and the rod bends, it's not going to break.
Yeah.
So you hold it up in an upward position high up off the water, and it doesn't break. And when you do it every single day, you realize what it is that you need. And when I realize what I need, I come back to my room, and I work on developing something like the backing and what have you. Here, and I get casting line that is 15 pound test. It's not that's going to break it. It's my leader's going to break long before that. But the leader can't break because you can't get any leverage on it. Because the rod is not graphite. It's good fiberglass.
Right. You use fiberglass rods?
Yes, I use fiberglass rods, and I've been using them forever. And I don't use bamboo because, I mean, they're beautiful to cast and they're beautiful to fish with, but they're fragile. And I don't want to have to worry about them all the time. My fiberglass rod that I'm using, hell, I bet I've caught 20,000 pounds of trout on that one rod. And it's like brand new. You know, the guides on my rod, I don't wrap decorative on my rods. I wrap only the guide, or the base of the guide, the foot of the guide. But what happens before I wrap the foot of the guide, I cut them down in half. So I'm using a lot less wraps on my rod than the average guy would use on if he was making his own fly rods. You see, all everything, nothing doesn't get touched. Everything, there's a reason for everything, and I incorporate all my equipment, and I incorporate it in my book. And people say, when are you going to do the next book? I said, why would I do another book? Everything is in this one.
It's all in one. That's perfect.
You know, it's good.
I love that. I want to dig in. Give me a few more. I want to dig into a few more secrets there that you have in your book, just so we can kind of whet the appetite for people listening. And are you doing a, so do you cover like indicators in there? Or what's the techniques you're covering in there?
I never used an indicator my whole life, and I never will. Why would you use an indicator? The strike is the most important part of stillwater fly fishing. When you feel a strike on that line, I've caught thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of fish. And every time that fly line moves out there, the leader moves, that's what I'm watching for. The last remaining part of the leader that floats, when it kind of dips down a little bit, that's a fish. I don't have to put an indicator on it. I know where that line is. I'm looking right down there. You see, all these things that people say, oh, well, you got to do this. No, you don't have to if you think about it. And it's probably better if you don't.
Right.
And with a fiberglass rod, I could follow backwards with a 7X tippet and not break a fish off because it just bends.
What if we were coming to let's say I'm going up to, what's a lake nearby you that's a pretty popular lake that you fished before?
Well, Elmenor.
Elmenor. So let's say I'm coming up there to fish with you at Elmenor and we're going to head up there. What is it? Is this a good time of year, like July, August?
Well, it's probably better than Yeah, well, it's hot, but I mean, we can still catch fish by going downfall. But I prefer to fish, you know, later on in the season when the water starts to warm a little bit and the fish are feeding early in the morning or late in the evening.
Yeah.
And, you know, bingo.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's it.
You know, everything has a purpose. Everything has a purpose. And I'm sitting here surrounded by purpose, you know, here. All my artwork is done. Want to see what a rainbow looks like? I've seen thousands of them. But if you want to see what a rainbow really looks like, fresh out of the water, you go out and you catch one and you hold it in your hand in the water. And people say, well, Lord, doesn't that hurt this fish? No, it doesn't. Because when you put your hand in the water, the slime doesn't come off the fish. It's it's there, and you don't squeeze the fish. You just gently hold them there. They're not going to move. The reason a fish squirms is because somebody's got a grip on it, and they're trying to get the fly hook.
Yeah, it's all set. And then, so if we were coming out to that lake fishing, let's just say in the fall, we're coming out there, would you be telling me to bring a float tube, or are we going out in a pram?
Well, we take my Boston Whaler out, and we find the fish, and we fish over them. The second day, we probably go out in a small pram, and we fish out of the pram. You know, we find the fish with the whaler where they're going to be, because they move. They're plagic, and they move all over the place. Wherever the water temperature is right for them, that's where they're going to be. And right now, there's been, you know, since the fires hit that area up there where Elmanor was, the devastation up there, you wouldn't believe. The trees are all gone. And so the water's all muddy because the wind blows all the time up there. And the wind, the trees don't block the wind. And so I'm not fishing as much as I normally would be because of the conditions. And I'm fishing closer to home. So, you know, just a ton of things. I mean, we could talk forever. When you ask a question, you ask good questions, and you allow me to go off on a tangent on whatever you say.
Yeah, perfect.
And this is perfect. And this is a perfect way of doing it. And I'm here all the time. So if you want to do these once a month, hell, once every 2 months, I don't care. You know, I love talking.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bear Vault, keeping wild adventure going strong and ensuring your next backcountry trip stays memorable, epic, and safe. Bear Vault builds a rugged polycarbonate locking canister that keeps bears and other animals out of your stuff. Every year you're out somewhere and you hear of somebody who had an encounter with an animal. And a lot of times could have been avoided pretty easily. Bear Vault is a way to keep your food safe, and it actually keeps the bear safe and you safe all in one shot. Bear Vault has come out now with two other version sizes of the Bear Vault. The small version they have now is like day hiking. So if you're out there going day hiking, you can grab the Bear Vault and you can go with it. Food story is a key consideration in the backcountry. Whether you're hiking, fishing, camping, whatever it takes, whatever you're doing, you're going to need something to keep your food safe. You can check in with Bear Vault right now. That's Bear Vault, wetflyswing.com/Bear Vault. BEARVAULT to support this podcast and a great solution for you. Okay, back to the show. So you wrote a book on stillwater, but you actually have also a lot of experience with steelhead and salmon. What's kept you from writing a steelhead and salmon book?
People, I don't want to send people out there. There's not enough salmon and steelhead left. And all the good waters have been ruined by the Department of Fish and Game, or PG&E, like the Smith, the Chetco, and all those. Man, they're not even a ghost of what they used to be. I mean, you know, that's where I use the pram, you know, because you can follow the fish, you can stay with the schools. And I don't fish in water that's 60 and 70 foot deep with lead core lines. I'm fishing at the mouths of the rivers when they first come in. That's when the fish is the best. That's when he still has feeding instinct. And then I fish with small flies, like almost like plankton. That's what they're used to feeding on. You see how this thing evolves? I mean, we can take it, striped bass the same way. You know, Russ Chatham and I fished for years in San Francisco Bay together. And we never saw anybody else because we fished where the fish were, and not where everybody was fishing. You see, a lot of people just, Joe Blow says, I fish underneath such and such a bridge. Okay, great. And they all go there. Not Russ and I. We go where the fish are.
Yeah, yeah. So they're coming there. And is that the same for steelhead, or are you chasing, or steelhead and salmon a little bit different on how you're finding them?
Well, steelhead takes the fly aggressively, where the salmon just sucks it in. I mean, that's all he does. He sees it in the water, he sees it coming down, and he just swims up to it, and he gets near it, and he just sucks it in. Well, what the hell? He doesn't grab a hold of it and start racing off with it. That's not the way they feed. Steelhead also do that same type of feeding in still water, in tidewater, but as they get further up the river, then you start catching them on brighter flies. But if you saw the flies that we use for steelhead and salmon, you shake your head. You wouldn't even use them for trout because they're so small. And they're tied on strong hooks, English hooks. And so they never get the fly. So, and you know, this old deal of bringing them up and putting them in a net and then taking a fly out of them, the hell with that. I bring them up to the boat, reach down, grab a hole, literally, I just break them off. The fly's going to rust off in tide water. You know, in a couple of days, it's going to rust out of their mouth. Why should I bring them up and take the slime off the side of the fish and hurt the fish? You see? And the fly, I mean, hell, I could tie these flies, you know, like a tie, 24 an hour.
Well, let's describe that fly. Is that a barbed or a barbless fly?
It's a barbless fly. I pitch the barbs out. I don't use a barbless hook because they don't make a sufficient hook that's strong enough to hold a salmon, especially on a swollen side. So what I do is I debarb all my flies, and I just push the barb down. I don't break the barb off. I just push the barb down, and it just slides right in there, and it holds in place, and that's all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple. When you see how easy it is to catch salmon and steelhead, you wouldn't believe it.
What is a good fly for steelhead? What would be a little tiny fly you'd be tying there?
Well, I tie scuds and stuff like that, and I couldn't give you the name of them because they don't have any names.
No, but they're little, small.
They're made with Mylar tinsel, you know, just one strand of Mylar tinsel, and you wrap the body and you use a little marabou tail, and you can use when you get up to the head, you use one or two turns of hackle is all you need. And that's it. Tie it off. And it's the whole thing is less than an inch long.
Yeah, a little tiny. Little
teeny guy. And man, do they work. I've got logs of all my fishing that I've done from the San Lorenzo River. I'm the only guy in the world probably ever caught a body with a fly rod.
A body?
A body, yeah. I actually caught a gal that had been strangled in Santa Cruz, and then I guess they threw her body in a river. And I was fishing, and I didn't know the body was there. And all of a sudden, I'm hooking something. I didn't know what the hell it is. And it's heavy, and I can't get it to come up. And so I start walking around to the other side of the river where there's a beach, and I start bringing it in. When I got him in the shallow water, and I looked down, and holy Christ, I got hooked her in the hand, in the ring finger over here.
Wow.
Yes. And then, of course, the cops came, and they came all over the place. And then they came down there, and they're all walking around with their patent leather shoes on the beach, you know. And I'm in my waders, and I'm standing with all the guys that I fish with. The officer says, "Who caught this body?" I said, "I did." I raised my hand. He said, "Would you come down here and put this body on this blanket here?" I said, "Hey, you see that culvert on the other side of the river?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "I hooked that body when I was on the other side of the river in front of that culvert. And I drug that body all the way around, across the bridge, across the road, all the way down below the roller coaster at Santa Cruz, underneath the railroad bridge, and onto the shallow bar there. And I pulled it up there in the shallow water as far as I could." He says, "Yeah." And I said, "I'm not pulling it one inch further. So if you want to get that body up here, you're going to have to go out there and get it yourself." He says, "Could I borrow your waders?" I said, "Look, I got a size 6 foot. I bet you have, what, a 10 or 11? "Yeah." I said, "You can't get into my waders." So you see, they get waders from another guy standing there that had a bigger foot, Ed Beckler. Anyway, then he goes down and he gets a body and he drags it up there. Then he says to me, "These guys are not very smart." He comes up there and he says, "Mr. Jansen?" I said, "Yes." He said, I want to get a description of everything that you saw out there. And then I want you to come down and identify the body as the body that you hooked. I said, "Let me tell you something, pal. If you go down there and you look at the right hand and the ring finger of the right hand, you're going to see a little small orangish fly. And that should be identification enough. Or if there's too many more bodies out there with little orange flies in it, I'm not fishing here anymore." Everybody just busted up the office. I mean,
wow.
That time, 100 people on the bank there. But anyway.
So at what point did you, when you hooked that body, at what point did you realize it was actually a body?
I didn't realize it was actually a body until I got around this other side. I thought it was a seal.
A seal?
Yeah, I thought it was a seal because she was wearing brown leotards and a brown ski jacket. And she had a white, kind of a pink sleeves, some stripe or something in pink on the sleeve. And I kept seeing the pink on the sleeves every once in a while, but that was about it. Well, I didn't know what that was until I got it up. And then I thought it was a seal because seals are coming into the river all the time to chase the salmon and steal it at night.
Oh, yeah.
Guys that fish a lot will go down there at night and they'll shoot them.
Oh, wow.
They'll shoot them with a 22. And so, you know, it wouldn't be nothing to hook a seal and drag it in.
Oh, right.
But they're a lot heavier than this gal was. And the tide was working for me, or else I wouldn't have got the body in. It would have been history. You know?
Jesus.
And that was in the newspapers, and everybody was calling me about that. And,
wow.
And I'd kind of like to forget about that one. You know?
Yeah, forget about that one. Is that the craziest thing you've ever hooked on a fly?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
What's the second craziest?
Man, there's a bunch of them. I once caught a sturgeon on a fly. I actually caught it in the mouth on the Paper Mill Creek. And I've got photographs of it, and it was all in the newspapers and everything. But I caught this sturgeon, and it's probably, well, I'm about 5'10", 5'9", something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's my width.
Yeah.
I'm pretty stocky,
mm-hmm.
let me put it that way. And anyway, the seal is a sturgeon. I'm fishing in Paper Mill Creek by myself, you know, and a friend of mine comes down. And he says, "Hey, what's going on?" I said, "Not much." And he says, "Caught anything?" I said, "Well, I've had a couple of grabs here. And your fish are rolling enough." And all of a sudden, I go, "There's one," and I hold up the rod, and it was just almost dead like on it. Now, what the hell is this? The guy's name was Steve. I said, "Hey, Steve, can you see what the hell it is? I'm gonna bring it right into the bank here. I want you to take a look and see what it is." And all of a sudden, the sturgeon that is probably, I want to say, a good 6 or 7 feet long.
Yeah.
Just surfaces. And there's the fly, the line going right to its mouth. The fish was sitting on the bottom and was probably breathing there. And the fly came by and it just accidentally breathed it in. He didn't take it.
Oh, wow.
He didn't aggressively go after it. And all of a sudden, I got the sturgeon. I got the picture of the sturgeon. And I'm holding it. It's right here in front of my fly tying bench. And I get the fly out of it. He says, "What are you going to do with it?" I said, "I'm going to let it go." "What the hell am I going to do with a fish that's like 65, 70 pounds?
Jeez.
What am I going to do with it?" He said, "Well, I like to eat sturgeon." I said, "Well, then you catch one." Because this one here is going back in. I get the fly out of the fish's mouth. And I got the fly sitting on the photograph, taped onto the photograph, and a little piece of the leader, and I let the fish go. And then this guy is telling everybody in the world about me catching a sturgeon on a fly. Well, hell, you know, if a guy's looking for notoriety, I couldn't ask for it anymore. And I'm not looking for notoriety. You know, back in those days, I was, you know, wearing a beard. I had a beard and Hodgman waders. You know, you couldn't get neoprene waders in those days because they didn't have. But I caught a sturgeon. So
wow.
I've had a lot of experiences, and I could probably write a book about all these experiences that I've had and some of the places that I've gone.
Yeah.
But I'm at that point in my life where all I want to do is my fish carvings, and I'm working on carvings that are so realistic that even a fish would try to spawn with one of my carvings.
So you're carving fish out of wood, and are you doing this based on a photo or just out of your memory?
Memory. And they're made out of basswood, carved out of basswood, and they're all hand-carved. You know, there's no. A lot of these guys are carving with power tools and stuff. I use actual tools that dig the wood out and, you know, draw the what I want to dig out, and then I dig it out. And then when I'm done, I paint the fish with an airbrush, and then I scale. Every scale on that fish is, because I take close-ups of it, I put scales on the fish, paint the scales down. I don't even go to the carving shows anymore because when they see me coming with a fish, they all get the hell out of there. You know, they know that they don't have a chance. And I got these fish sitting here, browns and cutthroat and and brook trout and bluegill and you name it, it's there. And got them in a lot of different shops. And I love carving. I just love carving all that detail. I love the detail.
That's really cool. So you've had that detail from the pin. I mean, where is that? Yeah, where'd that come from? That skill of these fish are beautiful. I mean, how you just developed that from like the pinstriping? Is that where it started?
That's right. The pinstriping gave me the ability to balance my hand and learn to balance my hand from drawing long lines and stuff like that. And I make all my own brushes, and I make them with quills from ducks and geese. And, you know, I got hundreds of brushes here that I made, and every one of them is for a different reason. When I start scaling, some fish have bigger scales, some have fish smaller scales. Like striped bass have big scales, and yellowtail have bigger scales. Steelhead and salmon, medium scale. And then when you get the bluegill and small some trout, they're smaller scales. And so you have different size brushes for every scale. You know, my whole life is in this room, and you would not believe everything that's stuffed in here. I find stuff. I got a grayling up there that I caught in the widow's pool with Joe Brooks, and I mounted that. I didn't carve it, and mounted it. And you would think that it was a carving, or you would think it was, you know, it's a skin of the real fish. Put on Richard Brooks right up there, you know, that I caught with Joe Brooks, you know. And then I've got decoys in here. I've got everything.
What was Joe Brooks like?
He was a gentleman. He was from the East Coast, and he was an Eastern gentleman. Every button on his shirt was buttoned. Everything that he wore looked brand new. Nothing was out of shape. You know, his hair was thinning a little bit because he and Mary had been married together for a long time. Yeah, usually you lose your hair when that happens.
That's right.
But, you know, he was a gentleman, an absolute gentleman. And there isn't probably an hour in the day that goes by that I don't think about Joe. And Ed Rice, who did the International Sportsman's Expos.
Yeah.
These guys are like, in my head, they are the epitome of everything that goes on.
Who are the other guys, Hal, that you know, over your career, you know, especially earlier on, maybe some of those older guys that maybe aren't around, who are some of the people that, you know, we'd know of that you were around?
God, I'd have to sit down and really think about it.
I mean, Joe Brooks, you mentioned Joe, and that we did an episode with Joe Brooks, I guess his nephew who did a documentary on his life. So we talked about that. And then, but I haven't heard much about Ed Rice. I know he did all the shows. He was a big, you know, person there. What happened? Did he just kind of quit doing the shows eventually?
No, he sold the show.
Oh, he sold it.
He sold the show. And then he retired to Oregon and was living in Oregon. And then he got sick and he needed to have somebody take care of him. And he lived in Oregon, and that's where he passed away.
Oh, there you go, in Oregon. Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, all these guys were my friends.
Yeah, you knew them all. And the steelhead was the same thing. I mean, you were there in the early 60s. What were the big steelhead rivers in when you started fishing steelhead?
San Lorenzo, the Russian, the Gualala, the Noyo, the Smith for salmon, and occasionally a big steelhead. But the San Lorenzo River is where I spent most of my time in Santa Cruz because I was going to school at San Jose State, and it was just half an hour over the hill. And my mom and dad had a summer home over there, so I had a place to stay. See, everything is like my whole life, it was set up in advance of what I was supposed to do.
That's what I want to get back to. I want to get, because it's interesting to me, because when you talk, and I'm always interested in the kind of the business side, because you've been able to do something that was a while ago. But I mean, you started tying flies. So once you started tying flies, what was the next transition into making money in fly fishing after that?
Having somebody else tie the fly the way I wanted it tied, and like Umpqua Feather Merchants, you know, they were using my name and tying my flies. And I had complete control over those flies. If they didn't look right, they sent me a bunch of them. If they didn't look right, they just eliminated them. They threw them away. They tied them the way they were supposed to be tied. See, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
What was one of those named? Do you, because they named their flies. Did you have a name of any of those flies with Umpqua?
Chihuahua. The Chihuahua fly.
Chihuahua, like the dog.
Yeah, like the dog. Because I'm standing on the Santa Rosa River, and I just got through catching a steelhead, and this guy said, "What'd you catch it on?" And I said, "The Chihuahua fly." And he was, "What?" I said, "It's right here. It's on my first guide." He looks at it. I give him a line. He's looking at it, and he keeps turning the rod. He said, "This fly doesn't have any hair on it." I said, "No kidding, really?" I said, "That's why it's called a Chihuahua." He said, "What is that?" I said, "It's Mylar tinsel, and then it's been ribbed with ostrich, and that's it." And he said, "This fish ate that?" I said, "Yeah, because that's what the plankton looks like that they eat." He said, "I'll be darned." I never saw the guy again in my life, but he's the one that came and gave me the idea for the Chihuahua, the name Chihuahua. And I used that fly for probably 5 years and never had a name. And people say, "What are you using?" Well, I said, "Oh, it's a little fly that I tie, you know." But that one, that guy said, "Oh, it has no hair on it. It's like a Chihuahua."
There you go.
And yep. One. Isn't it crazy life that I live? It's crazy. I sit down at night. I can't sleep immediately after going to bed. I lay there and I think about all the crazy things that I've done in my life. I could write 10 books about all the things that I've done in my life, where I've been, what happened. All these things. I got notes. I got volumes of notes here of things that were.
Yeah, you're going to have to write another book for sure. So when you were doing the, that pinstriping, did you do that for quite a number of years?
Oh, God, yeah. I travel all over the United States doing it. Yeah, I was the Little Striper. The Little Striper. That was my name.
Oh, that was the name of your company, the Little Striper?
No, the Little Striper. I'm 5'4". I'm not very tall. Every fish I hold up looks big because I'm so short.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I was made to fly fish.
Yeah. And you did the, who was the other guy? You did some the striping with somebody else, right? That also fly fished?
Well, not really.
No, you're just doing it.
I was doing it. I was traveling with car shows and going to outdoor car shows, indoor car shows. I got the Jaguar. It's 1967 Jaguar that belonged to Nancy and Ronald Reagan. I own it. And it's gold. And it is beautiful.
You have a gold Jaguar?
Gold Jaguar, chrome rear end. The motor is chrome. You can eat off it. And it's in my place up at Lake Almanac. Lives in the house up there. And I drive it occasionally. My son drives it more than I do. And these are all things that a lot of people don't know about me.
Yeah, what was the Jaguar? What year is that Jaguar?
1967. The license plate number is XKE325. And 325 is Ronald Reagan's birthday.
No way.
Yeah. And that's how I got the
car. Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. The 67 is that really cool. It's like a coupe just for like two people, right?
Yeah, that's right. Two people.
Oh, wow.
And it's a whole other interior. It's unbelievable. And I'm looking at it here. I got a picture of it here in a car show.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't believe it. And then, of course, I pinstriped some of the lines on the car.
Wow.
You know, but all just stuff is decorative, you know, beautiful. Not a wild line.
And you're trusting your son to drive it. That's pretty, you got a lot of trust in your son.
Well, he watched me build that car. So, yeah, I got a lot of trust in him.
Is it a convertible?
It's a coupe. It's a coupe, XK coupe. So it's a hard top.
Hard top, yeah.
Yeah. And with the wire wheels and, you know, it's just.
Oh, yeah, the wire wheels, yeah. It's a Jaguar. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. So that thing, could that thing go pretty fast?
Yeah, well, it would go 160.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not that I drove it that fast because the highway patrol could never catch me.
Yeah.
But they were driving Dodge Interceptors that went 120 at the time. And that was fast for that. But this car here would leave him in the dust. But it was gold in color, and nobody had a gold Jaguar. And a lot of people in the car world, like I used to get all the car craft magazines and hot rod and stuff like that. I've got all those magazines from way back in 1954 when I first started collecting them. You know, the little books, the little small ones, car craft, rod and custom are all small. I've got all those. I got them until I quit making them. And they're all in this room. Everything is in this room.
It's got, that car has an abnormally large engine compartment. Does it just have a massive engine under there compared to the car?
Yeah. The whole front end of it is long. It's long. And when you lift the hood up, you can't believe it because it's all motor. It's a six-cylinder overhead six.
Wow.
And yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
So that's it. When did you build that?
Oh, back in the early 60s.
Yeah, early. So 1960. Mm-hmm. So you were born, you said you were born in 1947, is that right?
43.
Oh, 43, yeah. So you're born in 1940. Yeah, so you're born 4 years after my dad was born, and so 43, and then when did you retire from the pinstriping?
Well, I never really retired from it because I still do it. I'm still able to do it.
But oh, really?
I got my bushes here, but I'm away from all those people that I used to pinstripe for, so you know, every once in a while, somebody shows up and calls and says, "Hey, I want my car. I want you to stripe my car." And then I say, "Yeah, come on up." You know, but I haven't been striped in, you know, 6-7 years. You know, every now and then I bring the brushes out to still, you know, to make sure I still know how to do it. And I guess it's right. But my hand is like a rock. You know, I set it down, boom, that's it. There's no wiggle, there's no shaking or nothing.
Wow.
And I can go walk down the side of a car and put a pinstripe on it.
So it sounds like you got the fishing obviously has been a huge part of the time you've spent, you know, but also pinstriping and doing these carving. What other hobbies do you have out there that we haven't talked about?
Oh, God. That's really about it. I mean, those are the serious ones.
Yeah, that's a lot. You know, that's a lot.
You know, the room here is covered with these plaques from Hall of Fames and stuff like that. And I belong all the Fly Fishing Hall of Fames. And It's an amazing world, amazing life that I've had. I'm married to the greatest gal in the world. She lets me do everything that I want to do, and she trusts me. And nobody ever really trusted me like that. And I got the best. I got a great-looking woman. She's a great cook.
Wow.
She's willing to go anywhere with me and do things. And well, you couldn't ask for any more, you know?
Yeah. Did she ever get into the fly fishing?
Well, she wasn't interested in it. She did it, but she wasn't interested.
What about your kids?
Well, yeah, both of my boys fly fish, and they, you know, they do the same stuff that I do. You know, I've taught them all very well down through the years. And my wife just handed me a note. Move on to fly fishing. Well, well, you're gonna want to call me again later on.
No. This is what's great about our show is that you know, sometimes I'll have guests on, even though it's a fly fishing show. Sometimes we won't even talk about fly fishing. We'll just dig into, you know what I mean? I've had a number of, like, Joan Wolf was on. We had Joan Wolf on in episode 100, and she, at the end of the episode, she gave me advice on relationship advice, and it was perfect, you know. So I love when the conversation goes a little.
She tell you to stay single?
No, she told me. I asked her. I'm trying to think now. Now I have to put a link in the show notes to it. But she said, "Oh man, I can't remember the advice now. I'm gonna have to re-listen to it." But it was good advice. It was really good advice. I'm just drawing a blank on what she said. That was 100. That was episode 100. That was 250 episodes from ago. So that was that was 4 years ago.
Well, we haven't talked about fishing much, and I just got a note from my wife about we should talk about fishing. But you know, I'm here, and I'll talk about fly fishing. I'll talk about anything you want to talk about. We've talked about the book, and the carving, and what have you, and you know, there's just a ton of things. And I'm here. And I've got this room, and it's quiet. And James, write me a note.
What's the number one fly?
What's the number one fly? A leech.
Oh, a leech. That's a good question. I like this. So the leech, because I was going to ask you that, Hal, because I went up, I fished with Phil Rowley up in Kamloops, and we fished like chironomids. And then I came down and had another guest on who was from Team USA, and he was talking about how his woolly bugger was his favorite, or it was a good fly for him. So is the leech your favorite fly?
It's one of my favorite flies for trout. Yeah. Steelhead and salmon is totally different. But that leech is so easy to tie that you would throw it into places where you don't expect to get it back.
Yeah.
That's a good fly.
Yeah. So what's the, on the leech, Is it like a woolly bugger? Does it look a lot like a woolly bugger?
No. You tie marabou in the back. It's in the book. You tie marabou on the back of the hook for the tail, depending on how long you want it. And if you have a 1-inch tail, long tail, the next bunch of marabou is tied on just about maybe a quarter of an inch or a half an inch in front of that. You just tie another bunch on, same size of marabou. And you go all the way up the shank that way. When you're done.
Oh, you wrap it. Wrap it with marabou.
No, you don't wrap it. You just tie it with the thread, and the marabou just is, it's just like a marabou.
Oh, yeah.
And it goes all the way to the front. And then you tie it off. I wrap a little bit of marabou at the front and on the thread, dub it on, and I wrap it, and that's it.
So no hackle.
If you lose it, you don't, yeah, if you lose it, you don't cry. The fish love it. I tie it in browns and olives and grays and stuff like that, different color. And I can fish that fly anywhere and catch fish on.
How do you fish it? If you had that fly right now and you're out heading to a lake, how would you describe how you would fish that in the lake?
I fish it with a number two line, two sinking line, or a clear line. And I would fish it in the coves, you know, where there's weed beds along the edge of the cove. And I would fish it adjacent to the weed beds. In other words, I would fish it or set the boat out front with a float tube, and I'd cast down along the edge of the weed beds, and I'd hand retrieve it, you know, with fingers. And four fingers is a long pull. Two fingers is a small pull. You know, your thumb catches it, and you just keep doing it that. I'm telling you, it should be outlawed.
Yep.
Should be outlawed. I have taken fish that you would not even believe in places that you wouldn't believe. I mean, huge fish, brown trout.
Yeah. Are you catching those? I know Denny, when he was on, he was talking about how he only fishes in the shallower water because fish are moving. Have you ever caught many fish out in the deeper water?
I caught them everywhere. I catch them everywhere. If they live in shallower water, and I know they live in shallower water, I'm going to fish in shallower water. You see, that's the one thing about me. I got in this book on page 126, it shows me holding a 20-pound leech-eating rainbow trout about to be given its freedom, released, unharmed. Okay? And on the other page, on the other side, there's a rainbow caught on an olive leech in Klamath Lake in Oregon. And it's probably about 12 or 13 pounds, maybe 14 pounds. And they all got their freedom. They're back in there. They're still living. You see? And that fly, do you take that fly? I could tie it without a vise. I could tie it, just grab a bunch of red marabou flies, put them in a Ziploc bag, and put them in my pocket with some hooks. And I could hold the hook in my fingers, and I could tie a marabou leech,
yep.
A black one, whatever. And that's easy. If I lose one, I don't cry about it. Tie on another one. You know?
Yeah. So you like the leech. You like the leech.
I like the leech. If it was my one fly to go to for everything, I've used that leech with yellowtail. I've used it for salmon. I've used it for everything, and everything bites it, you know. And woolly buggers, you know, why go through the trouble of tying a hackle on a damn thing?
Yeah.
You know, boom, just use them anyway. And that's what Gibby's fly is looking like, is a leech.
Yeah.
But not a simple leech, you know. One that's got a lot of pizzazz to it. I got his book right here. Denny's a good guy.
Yeah.
And nothing against Denny.
Today's episode is sponsored by Jackson Hole Fly Company. They've been designing and manufacturing fly fishing equipment and flies since 1978 in their home base in Wyoming. In 2020, they launched jhflyco.com and started selling gear directly online to anglers all over the country. You can go ahead and right now check out their huge selection of rods, reels, fly lines, tools, accessory. And right now, if you go to jhflyco.com/swing, you can get 25% off your first order. Just like Amazon, they'll ship everything directly to your door, saving you time and money. But unlike Amazon, you'll be supporting a great fly shop and this podcast by simply grabbing a few products, maybe just a couple of flies. Check it out. There you go. Get free shipping right now. All orders over $50 and get that 25% off your first order. jhflyco.com/swing. Okay, back to the show.
Who else is out there in the Stillwater? Because I mean, I've heard of you and a few other people, but I haven't heard of a ton. Are who are the other any other Stillwater anglers out there you know of that are kind of have written, you know, books or anything like that on Stillwater?
No, nobody.
Really?
Nobody's done those books. And nobody's done a complete book. Denny's book is about, you know, pictures of the fish that they catch. But it doesn't tell anything about the techniques that they use.
Why do you think that is, that there's not more Stillwater fishing books and like gurus like yourself out there?
Because people don't like to fish in water that's still. They like
no
streams.
Kidding.
Streams are beautiful. And they move slowly. They move fast. They move in all different directions. And you can get to them easily. You can wade a stream. With a lake, you got to have a boat, or you have to have a float tube, or you have to be able to wade out in that lake and cover where the fish are. Most of the time in lakes, we're in shallow like that, like Henry's Lake, where the fish are, they're in the channel, and you can't get to the channel. And the fish feed up and down the channel. So it comes out of the springs, and it comes down the channel, and it feeds out into the lake. And it's a straight run. So what do? The average guy is out there in his boat, and he's casting across the channel. Why in the hell would you cast across the channel? The fish are sitting there looking up the channel, taking the cold water coming in. So turn your boat, get along the edge, turn your boat, and cast down across. You see? And then you can fish slowly because the current coming out of that spring is keeping the leech tight. And it looks just like a leech. And when I stop it, it kind of puffs up a little bit, just like a leech. Now, what the hell would you use anything else on your line for, or why would you tie a leech any other way? It's because you don't know anything about how to tie marabou. See, a lot of my steelhead flies have a marabou body and maybe just a little bit of a hackle. Salmon and steelhead, I got flies that you wouldn't even believe. I open the box and you look at it and you go, what the hell is that? It's my steelhead box. You're kidding me. Where's the wings? Where's the long tails? Where's no, not me. I fish for a living, and I know how to fish, and I know what the fish like, and I know where they are, and that's all I need to do right there.
Yeah. Have you ever done any guiding over your time?
No. Well, I did up in Take It Easy Ranch in Oregon, but that was more technique than anything else. We caught lots of fish, but I don't guide because, I mean, I have the patience to guide. I just feel sorry for people most of the time because this is a simple thing we're talking about. This fly fishing is simple.
That's the thing. You say it, but I mean, for a lot of people struggle with, you know, like the casting, right? That's one thing. You know, casting is a big struggle for people, or, you know, getting into it.
Yeah. Well, because they're using graphite rods, and that's all that's available to them now. If they had a fiberglass rod, they'd be able to cast a lot faster, a lot quicker. They'd learn faster because it's a very forgiving material. You see, everything has a reason. Everything has a place. And with me, if it doesn't have a place, I don't have it. I don't need it. I don't want it. You see, I love talking to people about fly fishing. And especially like yourself, because you're understanding what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're trying to completely simplify fly fishing as much as possible, which sounds perfect, because I think a lot of the struggle when people, if they've never fly fished, they think it's really hard. And you're saying,
That's right.
And you're saying what you're teaching, like easy woolly buggers, a forgiving rod, you're saying it's, you could take somebody, a brand new beginner out and have them into fish on a day, first day, maybe.
I can have them in the fish immediately,
yeah.
You see. And I'll show them how to tie flies in the evening after we fish. That's why I went up to Take It Easy Ranch, and I fished up there because the food was good, and they served it right at a special time. So you always wanted to be there so you didn't miss the meal. And if you had plants with you or people with you, they had to be there at a certain time. And that's what fly fishing is. You have to be there at certain times. You know, you don't want to be there at 09:30 midnight. You know, you can't see what the hell's going on. You can't see what the hell you got on. I might as well hook the fly to my dog's collar and let the dog run wild and let it pull line out of the reel. But no, it's a fish. And I bring him up. And I feel sorry for the fish, that the fish is so stupid to take one of my flies for something that actually it looks like eating. You know, I feel sorry for him. I bring him up to me, and I'm very gentle with him. I get the fly out. Everything is barbless. I get the fly out of them, and I get them on their way as quickly as possible. I don't have, in my book, I don't have a lot of pictures of me with fish because I don't keep them.
Yeah, you've never really killed any fish, steelhead or salmon or trout?
Oh, I have, yes. You know, like somebody said to me, hey, Al, what time are you coming in? Oh, I'm going to come in at 6 o'clock. Okay, up on the Smith, because all the guys stay in the same area. Yeah, come, bring a jack. And we'll barbecue it. And we'll feed 5 or 6 people off of it, or 7 people, or 10. Whatever, you know. And then I fish, you know, for a jack that's maybe 6 or 7 pounds. That's all there is to it. You see, my life has been a simple life. My wife is a great person because she doesn't put a lot of pressure on me to be something that I'm not. She lets me be me. And
that's really
very
cool.
Few women are that way.
Yeah.
And I am thankful for that.
Yeah.
I got a couple ex-wives, and I'll tell you, I wouldn't wish them on anybody.
Right. That's it. So occasionally I'll ask the question about, you know, what vices you have. So, you know what I mean? Like, what is your vice for tying? What sort of vice do you have? Do you have the same vice you've always had?
Well, I got a Thompson vice. You know, any vice that I use when I first started, oh, God. So far along that I didn't know how to spell Thompson in those days.
Yeah.
And I've got a great vice here. Dynaking.
Oh, Dynaking. Yeah. They're awesome.
Yeah. And that's what I got sitting here in front of me right now.
Yeah.
Is a Dynaking. And I got this big drawer. So I got 2 cabinets here with drawers on the top and on the bottom and 1 big drawer. And I open them up and I got everything that I could ask for to tie any fly.
Yeah. What was the last fly you tied? What was the last fly or the pattern? What pattern was it that you tied last?
A leech.
Yeah, there you go, a leech.
A neighbor was here, wanted to know what the hell a leech. You know, I said, it's in my book, let me show it. And I tied it for him. And most of the time, I won't even tie it on the mice. I just hold the hook in my fingers and rip it out. Because all I need, the fingers are my mice. You see? And I mean, we could talk for the next 20 days. And not even cover everything that you want to cover.
What do you like talking about more? When you say, I'm keeping it simple here today too as well, but if you say steelhead, salmon, we have a lot of people that love steelhead, but steelhead, salmon, or stillwater, what do you love talking about more?
Probably stillwater because it's more involved.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to know what the weeds are and where the bugs are living, you know, that the fish are eating. I mean, you know, guys go into a fly shop up in the Yellowstone and they buy flies right out. They haven't even been fishing yet. They're buying flies. Well, what the hell? You got to be out there. You got to be out there in Henry's Lake, or you got to be out in the Henry's Fork of the Snake, and you got to see what the hell the fish are eating. And then when you see what they're eating, they're easy to tie. You know, the tail and the legs move, the body moves. And that's why I use marabou for the body in some of this fly.
Yeah.
It moves.
When you're up there in the lake, how do you determine what they're feeding, they're eating, they're feeding on?
Well, you just look in the water.
Yeah, because it's hatching.
And then you look, everything is up on the top. Calabatus are up there, but the calabatus are usually over in the shallower water. But you know that there's leeches in that channel because people have been fishing that lake for hundreds of years, and they know what's in there. And the guys that fish it, Gary Howells and those guys, that Jim Adams, have been fishing it forever, it seems like. They know what the hell they're eating, and they know where to find them there. And there's a place called the Glory Hole out there. And that's where the Glory Hole ends, where the channel ends. And that is only between you and I and the lamppost, you know. It doesn't end. Where it turns and goes to deeper water, there's an actual turn there. So I can actually put my boat in a corner. And I could fish to the left and fish the drift, come back towards me slowly. Or I could fish in front of me, or I could fish to the side a little bit, and I'm covered fish in the water. Other guys are out there in the float tube, and they just get to the side of the channel, and they're casting straight across it. Nothing lives in that lake. It swims across that channel all the time. You see where the thought process comes in. Once I've been someplace, and I see what's going on, that's it for them. That's it for the fish.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, Stillwater, I mean, I know I fish a lot of Stillwaters, and sometimes, you know, it can be challenging because the first thing you think about is like, where are the fish, right? How do you find out where the fish are? What's your tip there if you come to a new lake and you don't know where the fish are?
Well, I find a channel or talk to somebody that's been fishing out there. I know most everybody that's fishing that come from all over the country, like at Henry's Lake. But if I'm fishing Hat Creek, I know Hat Creek like the back of my hand. If I fish in Balm Lake, I know Balm Lake. I know Almanor like the back of my hand. I don't need other people to tell me where to fish and how to fish. I know where they are. You know, it's not a real science.
Yeah.
People try to make it a science, but it's not. It's simple. And I've got 50 times more material here than I ever need. But it's stuff that I've collected down the years or people gave me. And so what the hell, you know?
Yeah. Are you still doing, are you still going out to like shows and things like that?
No, I'm not. When Red Rice passed away, I quit doing shows. I don't even go visiting anymore because, you know, most of them, they're put on by promoters that don't know anything about fishing.
Yeah.
And they hire names. They hire names. Denny Rickers. And they go down the line. You know, if I started a show, you wouldn't know anybody in that show. But they would have information, and they would know how to talk. You see, that's the whole thing. If you're at a show and you don't know how to talk, you're done.
Yeah. Did you do that for Ed Rice? Did you, when you were there, did you do the presentations and all that stuff?
Everything. I did everything. I did casting.
Oh, wow.
I did fly tying. I mean, I did everything. And I traveled with that same thing. I went back, and Dave Whitlock was doing a show back east.
Oh, yeah.
Dave had me go back there. And he met me back there and paid for my all the stuff. And I get talked to some of the clubs while I was there. And You know, it's just once I get to some place, people know me.
Did you like the traveling?
I don't mind traveling. Yeah, I didn't mind traveling. You know, I mean, I enjoy coming home to my wife and the peace and quiet that I have here. But I don't mind traveling. I like getting out there. I like people. But after a while, I don't want to do it, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what's cool about this is that, you know, we've got a new generation of people probably listening now who maybe didn't know about you, you know what I mean? So I love kind of connecting to some of the history. I've been hearing about you for a long time, so this has been a lot of fun for me to just connect the dots. You know, we've been just chatting about stuff, but...
We've been shotgunning. We've been just shotgunning all over the place.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. You love it. This is great. Exactly. If we, obviously the Stillwater book is something, you know, you wrote that came out 10 years ago, but that's still, you know, it sounds like a great resource, you know, for people. If they want to dig in, right, that's probably the best place to go.
I'm telling you, if you like to fish Stillwater or you want to fish Stillwater and you don't have this book, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because everything that I learned in here has been learned over the last 50 years. Now, how in the hell are you going to figure out a spot right away? You can't. But if you read this book, it's in there. All the type of water, it's in there. You know, I could just stick my finger in this book and find a page and open it up and read it and go, holy.
Yeah, pull that out. Let's do that, Hal. But just randomly pick a page and tell me what you got there. I'm curious.
Yeah,
just
okay.
Just pick a random, just anywhere in the book, just for fun.
Okay. Well, here we go. The tadpole shrimp, which is probably the most... Yeah, it's a misunderstood bug. During the 60-plus years of fly fishing, one of the most interesting aquatic insects, fly creatures I have ever encountered is the tadpole shrimp of the genus Lepidurus.
Oh, wow.
This crustacean has survived unchanged since the Triassic period about 180 million years ago, or take a couple of years.
Yeah.
One of the reasons Lepidurus has managed to survive this length of time is its ability to produce vast numbers of eggs. Most species are bisexual, and the female is able to reproduce without fertilization by the male. The eggs can remain dormant indefinitely. Scientists have discovered tadpole shrimp eggs after 25 years or longer. They were dry. They were dry for 20 minutes. When the water in a pond or winter pool evaporates.
Now I see I'm getting a little more on the book since I didn't have it in front of me. But yeah, you dig into entomology and go deep, it sounds like, on a lot of these topics. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I explain everything. You don't have time to figure all this stuff out. I did it. All I have to do is read about it and go fishing. And lakes are everywhere. Jesus, I mean, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's my point. Why fish something that isn't everywhere?
Yeah, that's what still surprises me about people. And like you said, that there's not that many people that are into Stillwater, because it's just like, yeah, you'd think with all the lakes we have, all the great lakes, that there would be more. But it's probably, what do you think, only maybe 10% of fly fishermen fish Stillwater? Or you think it's more than that?
Dave, I think it's because they're in awe of it. They don't understand it. It's not like a stream that has a couple of rocks in it and the water flows past it. They go, oh, shit, there's a deep hole down there. Okay, I understand that. But when they get out on the lake and they're sitting in a boat out there by themselves and they're looking around and there's water 360 around them. I mean, they're overwhelmed. They don't know what the hell to do. And that's why Denny's book is so successful, because Denny says, put on a woolly burger, basically. You know, because it's a, it looks like a woolly burger, and you just tie it on and you throw it out there and you look, you probe with it and you throw it as far as you can and you strip it in and you bury your retrieves. That's not Stillwater fly fishing, but that's what everybody thinks it is. Stillwater fly fishing is knowing the area that you're fishing like the back of your hand, understanding how deep it is, understanding whether there's current there, understanding how much current is going to be there when the wind blows and the water goes to one side of the lake and then it goes under and it comes back. And you're thinking that it's going towards that side over there, and yet down below, the water is going only to that bank when the water is down, when your fly is down about 10 feet. When it's down below 10 feet, it's coming back towards you, past you. You see, these are things that they don't understand.
Right.
That's what Stillwater fly fishing is about to me. It's the most difficult form of fishing ever, because you have to be in tune with everything that's going on in so many different ways. You have to know the water, you have to know the bugs, you have to know your fly line, you have to know your equipment, and your equipment has to be designed for it. People today think, well, I'm going Stillwater fly fishing. I need a rod that's made out of graphite, it's 9 foot long, that takes a 9 or a 10 line. What the hell are you fishing for? Elephants?
What weight do you like for the glass rod?
2 weight.
Oh, two weight.
I fish a 2 weight rod 99.5% of the time. The only time I don't fish with that is when I'm fishing Chinook salmon over on the coast. And then I'm usually fishing a 9 or an 8, you know. And
wow,
with a shooting head, a 9 or an 8 is not going to hit the water hard. So when you're fishing over in tidewater, you're not scaring them. You see, and you fish above them and you drift down to them. That's why you fish the tides. The tide, yeah, brings the fly to the fish without a lot of lacking.
Right.
You see, and that's, we're talking steel and salmon there for a second.
Yeah.
And it's all, everything is relative. I mean, everything is relative. I look around my room, everything is relative. All my fly time material is relative. I don't own a piece of chenille. I don't own anything like that. I own fur, you know, that I dyed myself, and I with my materials.
Huh.
You see how it's cut and drying.
Right. And that 2 weight you were talking about, the 2 weight. So you've got some big fish you've caught over your time in Stillwater. Were you fishing a 2 weight on some of those bigger fish?
Well, you would have to, because if you're fishing 2 pound test or even 1 pound test and you hook a big fish, you don't have a chance of getting them if you don't have a fiberglass rod. If every time the pressure builds up on the line, it breaks, what good is it? Well, graphite is a great casting tool. Oh, wonderful. Great. Buy yourself a casting tool. Don't go fishing. Go down to the casting ponds in Golden Gate or go down to a place where there's a casting pond and cast, because that's where it belongs. That's where you can cast 100 feet and go. Everybody goes, woo, long time. I don't cast that far.
Yeah.
I cast 40 feet, 30 feet. You know, everything I do is different, Dave, and I'm telling you, and you're learning that over this period of time,
mm-hmm,
that it's different. I'm doing things differently And I have a book out of how to do it differently.
I love this.
I'm not keeping my secrets, you know, inside of me. If I run across a guy and he's having a hard time fishing, I ask him what he's doing. And I tell him how to be successful right there on the spot. And then the guy catches something. He's like, oh, this is unbelievable. I caught a fish. You know, I catch him all the time. It's nothing to me. I know where I'm going. I know what I'm doing. I know where the fish live. I know what flies they eat. Listen, I'm the worst fisherman in the world for the amount of information I know.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so just back, I want to verify on that two-weight. So what's the largest fish you've caught on that two-weight on Stillwater?
Well, I've caught steelhead and I've caught a salmon on it just for the hell of it. You know, for the hell of it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I used it up on the Snake and Tidewater one afternoon when a guy told me that I couldn't catch a fish. You couldn't catch a salmon on anything but a 10-weight rod. And I said, shit, I'm usually fishing a 6 or a 7. You know, what the hell's the difference if you go down to a 2 or a 3? You know, it's all the pressure. You reach up the rod, you grab a hold of your assistant. You can't do that with graphite because when you put your hand up that rod, and you, that's a shear point, and you assist it, you break it. And I don't put up pressure. I put side pressure. So about the time the fish feels less side pressure and he starts driving from left to right, I'm over here on the right side, and I'm putting pressure on him, getting him to go back to the left. You see, I make him go where he wants to go. And my lines allow me to do that. My rods allow me to do that. My reels are counterbalanced. That's why they give up line so easy. Once they get down into that 6 and 8 pound test backing, I mean, there's a lot of backing on there. People look at that little reel and they go, boy, you wouldn't be catching a big fish on that. The hell I wouldn't. I got a lot of line on this reel. If he goes, he wants to go. If he wants to swim to New York, when he gets through swimming and he got all the line out of my reel, I just pick up the anchor and I'll say, hey, we'll go. You say, I mean, it's so simple. I'm not telling you anything that's revolutionary in the world of fly fishing. No, I'm a simple guy. You know, 1 and 1 is 2, and 2 and 2 is 4.
Yeah. Yeah, they make it hard. You're right. I mean, I think people make it hard. But you do have these secrets in this book, which is cool. I think this is definitely getting people excited to take a peek in this thing. So, all right, Hal. Well, thanks for all your time today. Definitely appreciate it. And, we'll keep in touch with you, and I'll look forward to seeing that book.
Okay, buddy. Good talking with you.
So there it is. Hal Jansen, wetflyswing.com/352. 352 will get you some good stuff there over. We'll see what Dom can put in here for you today. Hopefully we got some good stuff coming. Quick listener shout out before we get out of here today. Frank from Florida. Frank, I'm going to give you a virtual man hug right here, Frank. Frank sent me an amazing email in which he described how he's retiring soon and has been using this podcast to help prepare for traveling after retirement here. So this is pretty exciting. He's got sounds like he's got a travel trailer or some sort of RV. And it's just awesome to hear that this podcast is helping him prepare for that time to get out and go do some fishing, more fishing. So Frank, like I said, right back to you, man. Thanks again. If you, I would love to hear from you. If you get a chance, you can reach out to me, dave@wetflyswing.com. If you have any comments, I'd love to give you a shout out here on the podcast and just love to talk to you in person. If you haven't connected with me yet and you've been listening to this podcast, I'd really love to hear from you by email there, or if you're on social, that's easy too, Wet Fly Swing. Quick reminder, the trivia challenge, wetflyswing.com/trivia is a good chance to win a fly tying. This is a $100 value fly tying pack. Togens is giving these away this year, the rest of this year. I think we're doing 4 of them. And so if you want to grab one of these things and chance to win this, all you got to do is sign up, wetflyswing.com/trivia, and you're going to get what used to be called the mystery fly tying pack, but it's just pretty much loaded with a bunch of materials and everything else. So I'm going to let you get out of here. Wetflyswing.com/trivia. Reminder on that trivia challenge. And I hope to catch up with you maybe online, maybe on the water. We got some trips coming here. So if you get a chance, check in with me there. And I hope that you have a good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.